Yeah, we're getting into a really interesting topic tonight. Do all religions lead to God? It's one of those things that we hear quite a lot. As Christians, it's not something I guess we would accept, although even though there are some within the church who would say that all religions are true. There's been a big scandal in the States recently with a quite leading evangelical pastor over there who has come out and sort of talked in terms of hell being pretty much a minority option. You've got to try really hard to get there. God is so loving, and people of other religions, Gandhi, nice guys like that, just the poster boys, mind, I suppose, you know, they're okay. We don't need to worry about them. So it's quite a hot topic in our attempts to talk to people of other faiths as well, and none. It's a hot topic because people will say things like, hey, look, all the religions are the same. You just differ in the way you do things. It's just one God, isn't there? Or God is just one universal spirit or something like that. People throw these ideas back to you. I remember first encountering this sort of thinking when I was at university. I'd only been a Christian a year or two, and wandering around my hall of residence, and people would, you'd get into conversations with people, or people would say, you're in the Christian Union, aren't you? And I'd say, yeah, I'm a Christian. You know, I became a Christian a couple of years ago. And they say, you know, I really respect your faith. And for a while I was wandering around the hall thinking I must be the most respected man in the hall because it seemed like everybody said that. But actually it just meant they didn't want a conversation about Jesus because it was going to get tricky. So it's one of those awkward topics. If what Jesus says in John chapter 14 verse 6, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father except through me, is true, which I believe it is, and I hope we all believe it is, then there's a lot of people who are in trouble. A lot of people are in difficulty. And this question of do all religions lead to God has a very clear and definite answer. And the answer is no. And that could be the end of the evening. But in your relief, I'm going to do the long version of the talk as well. So a Catholic priest and a rabbi and an imam are sat talking in a university chaplaincy and decide that they don't find converting people to their own faiths hard enough anymore. So they decide a great challenge would be to go out and convert a bear. A week later, they meet up to share their experience. The priest goes first. He's covered in cuts and bruises. Well, he says, first I read to him from the catechism, and he responded rather violently, until I sprinkled holy water upon him. Next week, the bishop is coming to confirm him. The imam goes next. He also is covered in cuts and bruises and has one arm in plaster. Well, I explained to him the five pillars of faith, he says, with a special emphasis on fasting, which I felt was appropriate as the bear looked hungry. It certainly seemed to calm him down a little bit, and I led him in reciting the Declaration of Faith, and next month he's off on a pilgrimage to Mecca. Then we turn to the rabbi. The rabbi is actually in a hospital bed. He's in traction, covered in cuts and bruises, and most of his arms and limbs are broken. He's in a really bad way, and the rabbi sort of looks at them both with a twinkle in his eye and says, I really shouldn't have started talking about circumcision. Well, part of the humor of the story lies in the slightly quirky religious practices of the different faith groups in the story. And for a lot of people, that's all religion is. It's just a different set of practices, a collection of quirky things that differ in the details but sort of plug into the same universal spirit. Does it really matter if you're praying to a God called Allah or a God called Yahweh or whatever? Surely it's the praying and the God bit that is important, not the labels and the names. At our growth groups course last week, somebody was talking about a friend of hers who's got a bedroom which seems to sort of take that philosophy to heart, that sort of multi-faith, mishmash, supermarket religion. She's got crystals, she's got statues to various deities, there's a crucifix. And I dare say if you were to look around the room, you'd find more and more of those things, books and tracts of various different religions. It'd be like the spirituality section at Waterstones. I mean, if ever there was an incredible section of a bookstore that says something about our society. Isn't it the spirituality section at Waterstones? You look at it and you think you've just got so many disparate thought views all lumped under the same book coding. I mean, go to the geography section, they're all maps. Go to the science section, it's all science books. But hey, you've got like basically 50 books that all contradict one another. Amazing. We'll have a little bit of Christianity because most people like Jesus. We'll mix it with some reincarnation, because that just sounds kind of cool, doesn't it? I kind of like the idea of coming back as a bear next time. We're throwing some Muslim moralism and maybe just a little bit of Catholic guilt, all mixed together with a few spiritual stones, some rocks, crystals that I picked up in a market in India, and some prayer beads for Turkey. That's my spiritual supermarket. Philosophers call it pluralism. You could also call it relativism to an extent. But essentially, it's just the idea that as no one can conclusively prove which religion is right, they're really all just different paths to the top of the same mountain. Now, when the gospel emerged from Israel, when they started traveling around the Middle East and they left Jewish territory, the place it really started to encounter difficulties was in Greece, when they came to Athens, Greece, the philosophical center of the world at that time, really, where all the deep thinkers were, the men with the long beards that weren't Jewish and who just spent their whole time just sitting around thinking and debating, the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers and so on. And Paul sort of pitched up in Athens and did his usual thing of a street preach. It was quite amazing yesterday when we were at the men's convention. We all came out at lunchtime. You imagine 4,000 men emerging from the Royal Albert Hall, crossing the road into, is it Regent's Park? Hyde Park, just sitting around the Albert Memorial. And some guy just wandered past and thought, here's a crowd I can preach to. Really funny. 4,000 Christians all sat there going, do you think anybody knows? Or do you think he knows? But that all credit to him. I mean, and Paul did exactly the same thing. He pitched up in Athens, starts. I'll read to you from Acts 17. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his friends, he was greatly distressed to see the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, what's this babbler trying to say? Others remarked, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting. So I guess this would be like being invited into the Cambridge University Debating Society or something like that. It's quite a privileged position. Is it the Oxford Union or the Cambridge one that's the famous one? Both. Are they both famous? Are they? Okay. The Oxbridge University Debating Society. Is that where you went? Yeah. Very good. So Paul's in there preaching, and they say to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting? You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we'd all like to know what they mean. And it's got a lovely bracketed section here. This is Luke just explaining what goes on in Athens. All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there, they just spent their whole time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked round and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. Now what you worship is something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you. Several hundred years earlier, Athens had been hit by a plague. And in their superstitious desire to try and appease the gods to get rid of the plague, the Greeks were so desperate to work out what was going on and kind of do the right sacrifice at the right altar. They decided to cover their bets. They thought, well, okay, we've got our pantheon of gods already, 10, 15, 20 gods that they sacrifice stuff to. What if we've missed one? What if we've missed one? So they set up an altar to an unknown god. Talk about hedging your bets, isn't it? Amazing. And Paul decides to actually preach to the one who seemed to make the difference on that day and give him a name and explain who he is. It's really interesting to think about how Paul starts off there as he's facing this multi-faith mishmash in Athens. What does he do? He starts where they are. He starts by listening to the things they're talking about, and he goes and investigates their gods. And so what I thought we'd do tonight is actually take some time just to think about pluralism, think about this idea that all religions lead to God, and kind of just shine a bit of torchlight on it and actually say, well, does this idea stack up? And the way we're going to do that, I've got two basic questions I'm going to ask of it. Is the idea that all religions lead to God coherent? And then does it make sense of me and of the world at large? So is it coherent and does it make sense of me and the world at large? Let's have the next slide, David. Or maybe the one after that. Let's have another one. There we are. Is it coherent? So let's start with that question. Is pluralism coherent? By coherent, I simply mean, does it make sense? Does it not contradict itself? Let's take this basic idea of pluralism, that all the religions are basically the same, and we'll just shine some light on it. Let's think about several religions that, the average pluralist would describe as being okay. We'll think about Buddhists first. What's the Buddhist conception of God? Anybody want to chip in? Go on. Absolutely right. No conception of God at all. In fact, Buddha was very clear. We don't have a God, and I am not a God. Although there are some Buddhist sects that would actually worship him as God, but mainstream Buddhism, there is no concept of God at all. What about Christians? Go on, James. One God, yeah. Anything special about that oneness, though? Go on. Three, excellent. Yeah, one God in three persons. God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. And he's personally knowable. Very interesting. What about Allah, the Muslim God? What do we know about him? Pardon? Muhammad is the prophet, yeah. What about the God that he would claim to be the prophet of? Lucy? Yep, so he's totally transcendent, he's unknowable. Christians often talk about having a personal relationship with Jesus, but you would never catch a Muslim talking about having a personal relationship with Allah. He's impersonal. Is he Trinitarian? Is there three of him, or is just one, isn't he? He's a monotheistic God, yeah. What about Hindus? Isabel, come on, you've been doing this at school, haven't you? Lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of, I'm taking the mickey out of the Greeks for having 15 or 20. The Hindus, about 250 million lesser deities. And then they also have this thing called Brahma, which is kind of a big, all-embracing creator spirit, who again is impersonal, cannot be known. And pluralism says they're all the same. Yeah, what more can you say? They're all equally valid expressions of the same thing. When we make that statement that all religions are the same, we're saying that one that is three is the same as none. Which is rather confusing, because I'm just a simple fella, but it seems to me that if I say there is no God on one hand, and I say there is one God on the other hand, then I'm saying two very different things. I'm not saying the same thing. Do you see where I'm going? The argument is actually so simple, it's almost like I'm not being clever here. There's no trick in this. We can't say that a candle is on and off at the same time, can we? It's either lit or unlit. These are mutually exclusive states. Very difficult then to say that all religions lead to the same God, or all religions are just the same, and it's just a bit of local preference. Maybe you could make that claim about Islam and Judaism or something like that. One God, relatively similar in many, many ways. But actually the idea of Christianity and Buddhism, no God, Christianity, a God, that's just very simple, isn't it? When I started doing computer programming back in the 80s, I had a ZX81, and to program a ZX81, you had to have some knowledge of binary. Who remembers binary? Binary is, there are only two numbers in binary, there's naught and there's one. It's very simple. You could either be on or off. And there either is a God or there isn't. And if you've got one religion that says there isn't and one that says there is, they can't both be right. So saying they're all the same, that's just nonsense. That's just nonsense. Now, no matter how much the pluralists insist that two mutually exclusive statements are the same, they're talking nonsense. Let me show you what I mean. Here's a spot the difference competition from Pluralism Monthly magazine. All they've done is they've taken a photo and they're going to subtly alter it. See if you can spot 10 differences. Just chat around your table from these two identical pictures. Let's have the next one. There we are. See if you can spot 10 differences between these two identical pictures. Come on then. Anybody spot any differences? I mean, they're identical. They're the same. No, they're not. They're the same. And I've got a louder voice, so I'm just going to keep saying they're the same until you take it in and believe me. The world will adjust accordingly to the loudest voice in the room. That's what it feels like with pluralism sometimes, isn't it? When you're told the lie enough times that all religions are the same, you just begin to parrot it. I'm, of course, being a little facetious to make a point. Are all religions the same? No, they're not. They differ on kind of important stuff like the nature of reality. Is the world real? Well, if you're a Christian, you'd say yes. If you're a Buddhist, you'd say no. That's quite a problem, really, because those are quite important things. The nature of God, the nature of heaven, the nature of hell, all the kind of important stuff in a religion. And they all differ. Now, your pluralist friend might reply, but look, they all believe in love and charity and so on, and incidentally, that's not strictly true anyway. But even if they did, isn't that just kind of like saying that all countries are the same because they all have taxation and governments? Or how about birds and Paul McCartney are the same because they both have wings? Carol reckoned nobody would get that one. You owe me tenner now. Come on. All I'm doing, I'm cheating, I'm playing with the words. I'm playing with the words and twisting them. And the fact is just most people don't think about this stuff. So you can get away with saying like all religions are the same and they all believe in love and charity. They don't. But if you twist the words, you can make anything the same. There's a wonderful article I came across in the Church of England newspaper some time ago, a couple of months back now. The Church of England in Spain and the Roman Catholic Church in Spain have managed to agree a covenant on baptism. And there's just this lovely line in the article. It says, they've agreed that they both recognize each other's baptism, and they've also agreed to disagree about the theology of baptism. And you just think, what a nonsense. Yeah, we'll recognize each other's baptism, but the words can just mean whatever you want them to mean. What a nonsense. Pluralism is incoherent. It simply doesn't make sense if it's claiming that all religions are basically the same. Let me ask a different question. Does pluralism make sense of me and the world? This is what I call the mapping effect. Let's have the next slide up there. If you're on a hillside, next one actually, and another one. Go along. There we are. Here's two maps. As you can see, there's one here which has got, it's a city with a big circular motorway around it. We all know which city that would be, won't we? Which city is that?
Manchester.
Not sure, are we? Okay. And what about this one? There's another one with a big circular motorway. All right, two cities with big circular motorways around them. I could give you the both maps. You could find yourself on the motorway. How would you find out where you are? Sorry? Go on. Road signs. Yeah, you'd look at the scenery, wouldn't you? You'd look at what's around you and you'd have a look and say, well, it says there's a junction 24. I've just driven past somewhere called Oldham. Does that mean I'm on junction 24 on the M25 or junction whatever it is near Oldham on the Manchester Ring Road? Oh dear, I can't quite read that, which is quite handy, really. If a religion is true, it actually should describe the world, shouldn't it? I mean, it would be really unfortunate if the one true religion, whatever that might be, just bore no coherence to the world. If it's true, it ought to make sense of the world. It ought to enable us to make sense of what we see around us. So I call this the mapping effect, because when you're out in the countryside with a map, but maybe you don't know where you are and you haven't got your compass, one thing you can do is look at the map and think, well, there's a tree there, and there's a stream, and a river, and it's flowing down at a lake. Oh, look, there's a lake down there. You can start from the map to make sense of where you are. A map should describe reality. A religion should describe reality. Does pluralism describe reality? Well, it gets us straight into a massive problem because we've already seen pluralism is saying that all religions are equally valid. So what it's saying is that when Jesus says, love your enemies, it's on a par with Hitler saying, exterminate your enemies. Let's have the next slide, David. And that immediately just throws us into the whole area of, well, if love your enemies and exterminate your enemies are equally valid, then right and wrong's just gone out the window. They're an irrelevance, or best a point of view. And you begin to wonder, does that really make sense of the world we see around us? Is stuff like genocide just a matter of opinion? That's what the Nazi soldiers tried to argue at the Nuremberg War Trial. They said, well, we were only obeying orders. This was our culture. This was our law. And one of the judges actually responded, is there no higher law than the law of a country? Now, a pluralist would, of course, object to me saying that they're insisting that love your enemies and exterminate your enemies are one and the same. They would come out and say genocide is wrong. But I'd want to know how a pluralist could possibly say genocide is wrong, because if they're maintaining that all viewpoints are equal, what are they saying? All viewpoints are equal except the one I'm in, and I can look down on the Nazis? How can they declare Nazism is wrong without asserting that their own viewpoint is superior? Now, of course, they'd be absolutely right to say Nazism is wrong, but the moment they say it, they've stopped being pluralists, and they've taken on a value judgment position. So I think pluralism is incoherent on this one as well. It just doesn't make sense of the world. It doesn't help us understand right and wrong. It doesn't understand anything. The idea that all religions lead to God is just nonsense of the highest order. The question is, what can we do with that information? Because it's always awkward when you're talking to somebody of another religion, isn't it? And you think, well, where do I go with them? Dare I try to convert them? Well, I could take the pluralist route that we're all doing the same thing, so I don't actually share Jesus with them. That gets me off the hook. It gives me an easy life till Judgment Day, but it gives me an easy life for now, and we all want that. Or I say, well, actually, this guy needs to know about Jesus. So how do you start to share that? I mean, he's so sincere. He's so sincere in his faith. What? You know, maybe you've got a sincere Buddhist friend who sincerely believes that you're an illusion. And what do you do with that? Well, I think, first of all, we've just got to recognize that sincerity is no guide to truthfulness. Let's have the next slide, David. And we'll jump on another one as well. Here's something that people were incredibly sincere about. What's this ship? The Titanic. The iceberg's a bit of a giveaway, isn't it? Its builders, its engineers, and its designer were sincerely convinced that it was unsinkable. So convinced that they didn't put enough lifeboats on board to evacuate the whole ship, because they knew it couldn't be sunk, so why would they need them? You can be sincerely wrong, can't you? Or you might have a religious friend who has had some sort of experience. Religion X is true because something amazing happened. Sherry Booth, the former Prime Minister's wife's sister, I believe converted to Islam recently because she went to Mecca and had a religious experience. But trusting how we feel about something is a really poor guide too. Our feelings are hugely prone to manipulation. People go out into the desert, they go without food and water for days, and they end up having delirious and miraculous visions. Is that necessarily a surprise, going out without food or water? Perhaps that was just a near-death experience as they starved. You don't need to go into the desert to have an experience. Go and watch a football game. Get really into it and start leaping around until your head starts spinning. You can't do that at Sunderland because, of course, we never score any goals. But in the old days, you know, it's happened. Or go to a gig. Go down to a big Christian concert and wave your arms around in the air until you're mad. And you'll think you're having a religious experience. Until you go to a secular gig and do exactly the same stuff and have a very similar experience. Experience is no guide to truth. So how can we know what is truly true? Well, let me suggest two paths. First of all, we've got to explore its history. Any faith claim will have a history angle to it. But actually, Christianity's history claim is far better than most. The Bible claims Jesus was a real, living, breathing, historical figure in first century Palestine. And we can actually see him in the history of the surrounding nations. He's testable, verifiable. That's why so many books are being written at the moment trying to challenge the evidence of the first century Christians, and not very successfully. So look at the history. But also use those two questions I asked earlier of pluralism, because I think they're brilliant for getting under the skin of any truth claim. So one of the things I often find when I'm talking to young people sometimes, when they're talking about having difficulty relating their faith to their friends of other religions at school, that they get very defensive about what they believe. And one of the things you've got to realize is we actually have to go on the offensive and challenge other people about their beliefs. We don't have to spend all the time sitting defending what we believe. People come, why do you believe in God? Well, actually, it's perfectly possible to ask the question back, well, why do you believe what you believe? And those two questions, does it make sense of the world around me? And is it consistent? They're just brilliant for that. As you begin to probe what people believe, and you find that the more you talk to people with different beliefs to you, the less coherent their beliefs are, because they actually believe in often quite a slapdash way. Dare I say, like a lot of Christians do. So let me tell you something of the world I see around me and why I believe Christianity is the right way. In the world around me, I see extraordinary beauty, and I see amazing creativity, and I see it all tainted. And I see horror, and horrible evil, and sometimes with extraordinary beauty in its midst. Schindler's List, what an extraordinary story. I see love and selfless self-sacrifice, and ghastly selfishness, sometimes in the same people. I see an ordered world, and people longing to make sense of it. I see people isolated and alone, longing for community. I see despair, addiction, disease. I see families struggling to cope with life because they have no understanding of love. I see people longing to know God for themselves and to know their place in the cosmos. And I see people longing for justice, for God to come and put the world to rights. And I see lots of those things in myself as well. This is just the world around us, isn't it? I see in myself a capacity to be good, tainted by a very easy slide into evil. I see my love for my wife and for my children. I feel a great longing for relationship with God, which is tainted by the evil I do. I see my own failures and sin, my own contribution to the mess of the world. And I wonder how a wretch like me could have any hope when the world is put to rights. Those are some of the things I see in the world and in me. And that's why I'm ever more convinced that the promises Jesus makes stand up better to the world around me, to the mapping effect, than any other faith that I've encountered. I don't have time to explain all of Jesus' positions on those things I've just run through, but let me just hit a few highlights. Perhaps you can imagine Jesus pointing us to 4 points in history. There's a slide for each one, David. Keep going, let's have the next one. And the next one, and the next one. Two more, yep. Here's the first one. Jesus points us back to the perfect beginning for the world, which is spoilt by people. People and their harm and the lack of care they have for others are at the very center of the mess of the world. That's the first place he points us. Second place he points us, forward to a day when he'll return and come and put the mess to rights. The day of judgment, when all things are judged, and then some are made new, the world made new. The third thing Jesus points us to is now, and he points the finger at each of us, saying, on judgment day, Barry, is it going to go badly for you? What's your confidence, your hope on that day? What are you going to do about it now in response? And then, of course, there's the fourth thing that he points us to, the really amazing one, where he says, I love you by dying. I love you so much that rather than you letting you go and face the punishment you deserve, I'm going to step in and take it for you. It's a promise. I grew up an atheist. My parents are atheists. And God disavowed me of that delusion. Strangely enough, it did start with an experience. What I recognize now is an experience. But in time, as I learned to question that experience, I realized that there were far more sure places to base my faith, to base my decision to follow Christ. And I think ever since then, I've just been probing Christianity and probing the world and asking that question time and time again. Does what I read in God's Word make sense of what I see in what I acknowledge as God's world? And I believe it does. Better than anything else I've discovered. We've no time to go further on this subject, but I'd love you to spend some time on your tables just throwing some of these ideas around. There's a set of questions there with an ancient parable. I think it's an ancient Hindu parable that was updated by a 19th century Victorian poet. Have a quick read through the poem and just answer some of the questions. You've got about 3 or 4 minutes to do that,